Today is Friday, March 20th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Steve Miller in Washington. Governments race to ease the impact of the coronavirus.
Look, in this horrendous situation, there's nothing that's going to provide assistance that will make every situation feel like it's getting back to normal.
Plus, experts are concerned about the security of computer networks as more people work from home.
It opens up a bunch of vulnerabilities because you have a lot of people who are suddenly teleworking who haven't done that before.
And tensions between the U.S. and Iran continue. Those stories and more are all coming up next. COVID-19 has affected more than 245,000 people, with some 148,000 active cases. Of those, about 95% are in mild condition, according to Worldometers, a website that aggregates coronavirus data from multiple sites, including the World Health Organization and the U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. Dr. Lauren Ansel Myers, professor of statistics and biology at the University of Texas, Austin, told VOA via Skype what medical professionals are learning about the virus.
If we take measures now, we can limit transmission. We have seen outbreaks be controlled in other countries in the world when they take measures to rapidly identify and isolate cases, quarantine contacts of their cases, and enact other broader social distancing interventions. So I think there is some hope from the examples of other countries and other populations that if we are proactive, if we are aggressive, we can limit the spread in the short term.
David Beasley, the director of the World Food Program, announced Thursday that he tested positive for COVID-19. He says his symptoms are mild and that he remains in good spirits. Beasley is working with health professionals to trace anyone whom he may have been in recent contact with while traveling in Syria, Canada, and the United Arab Emirates. Beasley said that he and his team will continue the hard work the WFP does that so many rely on. Now, with over 2 million people behind bars, the United States has the world's largest population of incarcerated individuals. With so many people held in often close quarters, fears are growing of the COVID-19 coronavirus spreading inside America's prisons and jails. Several states and cities have begun releasing some prisoners to reduce the spread of the virus, while prisoner advocacy groups and some politicians are calling on federal prisons to free low-risk inmates. Now, to find out what can be done to prevent the outbreak among inmates, VOA's Jason Patinkin spoke with Dr. Tyler Winkleman, who is the co-director of Health, Homelessness, and Criminal Justice Lab at the Hennepin Healthcare Research Institute in Minneapolis, Minnesota.
Jails in particular, where you have individuals coming in every single day who can spread the virus without having symptoms is similar to having a cruise ship where you are sending new people on board every single day, not knowing whether an individual on that boat has COVID. So the more we can limit the number of people entering facilities and the more we can limit the total number of people residing in the facility at any given time, the better our chance of preventing a large outbreak in a correctional facility.
Looking at the facility that you work in, what are some of the things that your facility has been doing?
I work in a large urban jail on the medical floor. We're screening everyone for symptoms, for close contacts, for travels to places with high numbers of COVID-19 cases. If anyone screens positive, they're immediately placed in isolation and given a mask. And then one of the physicians is alerted and we make decisions about next steps. No one is removed from isolation until their symptoms are resolved or we have testing back that's reassuring. Everyone has access to hand sanitizer. We're putting out informational handouts so that people understand what COVID is and why some of these measures are being taken. We are doing temperature checks on a daily basis to monitor people for fever. We have appropriate personal protective equipment. And then we have worked very closely with judges, with correctional staff in the sheriff's office to really discuss the importance of trying to keep the population in the jail as small as possible. So over the past week, the jail population has been decreased by about 20%.
I mean, the things you're describing, are these widespread yet?
No, these are not widespread. Folks really need to be acting with a sense of urgency to implement these, and ideally before communities see large spikes in the number of cases in the community. In terms of practical advice for how to reduce the number of people in correctional facilities, so one is anyone who's over the age of 60 and has multiple chronic conditions. Those folks are at really high risk. That is a population that would do well to not be in a correctional facility. The second would be people who have technical violations from being on probation and are serving 3 months or a short period of time because of, and then third would be people who maybe have a month or two left of their sentence, thinking about an early release for those individuals. And then I would just also stress that it is absolutely critical that facilities, criminal justice systems are closely collaborating with the health systems in their area and with the public health department.
Dr. Tyler Winkleman is the co-director of the Health, Homelessness, and Criminal Justice Lab at the Hennepin Healthcare Research Institute. He spoke to VOA's Jason Patinkin. The Western U.S. state of California issued an unprecedented statewide stay-at-home order on Thursday for its 40 million residents, and Washington warned Americans to return home or stay abroad indefinitely. This comes as the pressure is growing on U.S. President Donald Trump as states sound the alarm about a lack of key supplies for handling the coronavirus pandemic. The AP's Sagar Magadi has more.
In a video conference with governors, the president heard Louisiana's John Bel Edwards and others say they may soon need federal help.
As early as 7 days, we can start to exceed our capacity to deliver health care.
But the president had earlier said it's on states to get what they need, not the federal government.
You know, we're not a shipping clerk.
He'd started the day by saying drugs and early testing could be a game changer for treating the virus.
And we think we have some good answers. We'll find out.
But critics accused him of being overly optimistic and misleading. The Food and Drug Administration later noted there are no approved drugs for treating, curing, or preventing COVID-19. Congress is racing to put together a $1 trillion stimulus package as the country moves toward a likely recession.
We need to take bold and swift action as soon as possible.
Mitch McConnell's plan would send Americans $1,200 checks and give hundreds of billions to small and big businesses while shoring up a healthcare industry bracing for a surge in virus patients. Chuck Schumer's Democrats have their own ideas, focusing on keeping workers from missing paychecks and helping hospitals.
Hopefully, each side will give.
McConnell says the Senate will not adjourn without reaching perhaps the biggest legislative deal in a dozen years. Sagar Magani, Washington.
Friday, Hong Kong-based airline Cathay Pacific announced it was cutting passenger capacity by 96% through May. Cathay's low-cost carrier HK Express is suspending all operations from March 23rd through April 30th. And a union official says Air Canada is laying off more than 5,000 flight attendants as the country's largest airline cuts routes and parks its planes. Asian stocks indices were mostly up Friday after Thursday's modest gains on Wall Street, and major European markets ended the day up between 2 and 5%. In early trading, the Dow Jones Industrial Average was up about 1%. Investor hopes that governments and central banks will help the world economy avert a global recession seemed responsible for the buying. But will that be enough? Now, to get the broader economic picture, I spoke with David Wilcox, a senior non-resident fellow at the Peterson Institute for International Economics.
Finally, I think policymakers have come to grips with the fact that this is going to be a multidimensional challenge of really historic proportions.
If you look at the bailout, what realistically can be done to really help industries without adversely affecting the global economy long term?
It's a hard situation. We literally have faced no precedent like it in modern history. One might reach for historical examples that could provide some baseline, but they're so distant that that they really don't give us much guidance about what to do today. I think the question for segments like the airline industry is going to be an agonizing assessment of what level of aid would be required to keep these businesses viable. And how, coupled with that, how long is the crisis going to go on for?
We look at some of the ideas being floated in the U.S. Congress and elsewhere around the world, the idea of some kind of personal bailout, a check to help tide things over. Is that really going to do anything in terms of sustaining the economy, given that there are so many shelter-in-place orders out there to prevent the spread?
Look, in this horrendous situation, there's nothing that's going to provide assistance that will make every situation feel like it's getting back to normal here, not until the progress of the disease has been arrested. And so let's take just one example. There are a lot of people who are going to have a terrible time making a rent payment here in the next month or two. We know that for sure. Eviction, if that's what it comes to, leads to all kinds of horrendous consequences. It leads to a very costly, time-consuming search for the next place to live. For kids, it can mean a change in school systems. For the parent or guardian, it can mean a search for a new job, because it turns out that the search for a new place to live is itself so time-consuming that oftentimes job loss is triggered by eviction. So even sustaining the ability to make a rent payment here for the next couple of months could be a really material assistance. The challenge, again, to come back to it, is finding a solution where enough cash can be gotten out through pipes that simply were not built for this circumstance.
David Wilcox is a senior non-resident fellow with the Peterson Institute for International Economics. The race to slow the spread of the coronavirus is placing an unprecedented burden on many countries' cyber infrastructure, potentially making it increasingly vulnerable. At issue are those who suddenly have been forced to telework and rely on the security of their own internet connections and good cyber hygiene to keep businesses and services running. The result, some officials warn, is an opening for anyone who would like to strike a vital blow. Now, to learn more, I spoke with VOA National Security Correspondent Jeff Selden via Microsoft Teams.
Well, there are a couple of concerns. First, that's putting an enormous burden on the cyber infrastructure, the networks, the systems, the computers that enable people to go online and get work done. The other thing this does is that it opens up a bunch of vulnerabilities, because you have a lot of people who are suddenly teleworking who haven't done that before. So they may not be as savvy about how to go about doing it. Companies may not be prepared for giving them the security tools online that they need to stay safe. And then, of course, there's phishing campaigns, ways that malicious cyber actors, criminal syndicates, possibly even some state actors are going out there and trying to find ways, backdoors into the systems, whether it's to conduct an attack on infrastructure somehow, or whether it's trying to steal information. So put all that together, and there's a lot of cause for concern.
And what do they recommend and how to address them? Because this is something that looks like it'll continue for the foreseeable future.
Well, part of it is just good cyber hygiene. And when they talk about that, the experts mean being smart, using VPNs to go in so you have a secure internet connection. But also some of it is just being smart when you're on email. Lots of businesses still rely heavily on email. And one company that we talked to, Proofpoint, said that so far they've seen numerous campaigns. One of them alone by cyber threat actors involved over 300,000 emails. A lot of these would be looking at saying, hey, you know, trying to get credentials so that they can log in at another time, or saying, hey, you know, pretending to be somebody from work, saying I can't get something done, so click on this link so you can finish this for me since I'm not in the office. That could be a malicious link or a malicious attachment that will then download some malware onto the user's computers, the worker's computer, and then later on they can get information that they need, or they can even, plant a virus that's going to activate at some point in the future when they needed to. So some of it is just being savvy, being careful, but it's still a lot of stress because you also have people working from home who aren't used to it, and there are distractions at home. You have a lot of families have kids at home right now who are walking in and out while parents are trying to get things done. So that kind of makes it even more difficult.
Jeff Seldon is VOA's national security correspondent, and still to come.
It's the craziest thing because I've really never done anything like this before in my life.
VOA's International Edition continues. I'm Steve Miller. After a short lull, things are heating up again in Iraq. The United States and Iranian allied militias are carrying out a new round of attacks against one another. Following a rocket attack on Iraq's Camp Taji that killed one British soldier along with two American troop members, the U.S. responded with airstrikes against Kataib Hezbollah. The U.S. blames the pro-Iranian Iraqi militia for those attacks. Rockets also struck the same base again on Saturday. The Iraqi military released a statement criticizing the U.S. strikes, and Iraq's foreign minister has summoned the U.S. ambassador to protest what was termed American aggression. VOA senior analyst Mohammed El-Shenawy spoke with Colonel David Desroches, associate professor at the Near East South Asia Center for Security Studies, about the situation there.
It's a real setback for de-escalation. You're right about that. What we're seeing is Iraq trying to keep pressure on the United States, trying to say that we dictate the pace of pressure, and really trying to push on what they know is the Trump's desire to leave Iraq, to get them to do it as quickly as possible, and to do it on Iran's terms rather than America's terms.
The Iraqi military released a statement criticizing the U.S. strikes, and Iraq's foreign minister has summoned the U.S. ambassador to protest what was termed as American aggression. What do you make of that?
We have to realize, you know, the Iraqi government is not completely sovereign. So if you're in Baghdad, there are elements that are freely roaming around Iraq, and particularly the eastern parts of Baghdad, some of which are paid by the Iraqi government, but which are primarily loyal to Iran. And in light of the American strikes, which I think were less successful than hoped for, they were reported as hitting ammunition depots, but when you look at the central command photos, you don't see fires or secondary explosions. So, and there were reports that Iraqi policemen were killed instead of or alongside Qataib Hezbollah operatives. So it's normal to expect this sort of thing. I expect that it will be rather pro forma. And I think that this also explains why we haven't seen an additional American response to the second wave of Qataib Hezbollah missile firing, because we want to be sure we get the targets right this time.
The Iraqi government was contemplating a complaint to the UN Security Council over the U.S. attacks. What should be done to assert Iraq's control over internal security forces, aiming to prevent Iran, pro-Iranian groups, and the U.S. from targeting each other in Iraq, to establish rules of engagement that protect Iraqi sovereignty and prevent future escalation?
You put your finger right on the heart of the problem. I mean, here's the real problem, which is the United States has already shown once that it's perfectly happy to leave Iraq. The United States is constrained by law and genuinely wants a sovereign Iraq. Iran, on the other hand, does not want a sovereign Iraq. They want an Iraq that's subservient to it, that basically is a province. And in some parts of Iraq, they effectively have that situation under control. They want full freedom of movement. They want an ability to bypass any democratic processes. They want the ability to unilaterally employ force in Iraq without consulting with the Iraqi government. I think that given the extrajudicial nature of some of these Iraqi militias, that it's quite possible that we have to view the Iraqi government to some extent as a hostage. And so we'll see measures like this, but I'm pretty sure that the dialogue we get in private with the Iraqis is different from the public statements that people have to make in Baghdad, because quite frankly, they're in fear of their life.
Would that reinforce the call for U.S. withdrawal as soon as possible?
You know, there's a dysfunctional thing here. Iran wants the United States out of Iraq, but the worst thing they can do is to attack American forces, because the U.S. government, particularly President Trump, doesn't want to be seen to be doing anything out of a state of weakness. The irony here is that if Iran and its proxies, and Qataib Hezbollah is a servant of Iranian interests, not Iraqi interests,
If they really wanted the United States out, they should just be quiet, keep their head down, and allow us to lose interest as we've done, and to withdraw. As the Secretary of Defense says, we need to focus on our prime competitors, which are China and Russia. So the Iranian strategy here really is dysfunctional, not just in terms of maintaining the peace in Iraq, which Iran doesn't really care about, but also in terms of advancing the Iranian strategic interests of getting the United States withdrawal from Iraq. So I think if after the next round of retaliation they say, okay, that's it, draw a line under it, then I think we'll be fine. But, you can never tell.
Colonel David DeRoche is an associate professor at the Near East South Asia Center for Security Studies. He spoke with VOA senior analyst Mohammed El-Shenawi. More than 7 years after the brutal gang rape and murder of a 23-year-old physiotherapy student in New Delhi that sparked an outrage across the world, four men convicted of the crime were hanged at dawn on Friday. Called the most brutal, barbaric, and diabolical crime by the Supreme Court, the 2012 gang rape shook India's conscience and turned the spotlight on sexual violence against women in the country. Minutes after their hanging, the victim's mother, Asha Devi, said her daughter's soul would rest in peace. All four men hanged were low-income workers. The execution of the culprits brings closure to a city where the gang rape brought tens of thousands of young people into the streets with a rallying cry of justice for the victim and an end to such horrific crimes. The U.S. presidential race is laser-focused on the last two viable Democrats competing in their party's nomination to challenge U.S. President Donald Trump in November's general election. But what about the candidates who have since dropped out since this contest began? VOA's Carolyn Pursuti found some diehard supporters who refuse to give up on or stop campaigning for losing candidates.
The look of democracy, voters campaigning for a candidate.
I wouldn't carry debt for myself, but I would carry debt for Andrew Yang.
Wait, what did he say?
For Andrew Yang.
Presidential candidate Andrew Yang dropped out in February, yet the Yang gang, his supporters, left their jobs and still travel at their own expense to bring Yang's message to voters.
I'm from Philadelphia.
From the San Francisco Bay Area.
I'm from Chicago, greatest city in the world.
Macaulay Kong switched his party affiliation from Republican to Democrat and voted for Yang.
When other candidates are courting him, the Yang gang, for VP or cabinet positions, we can also bargain for freedom dividend and the eradication of poverty.
Tulsi Gabbard was her name.
That's performer Eileen Tepper from New York City, who put her Broadway career on hold to volunteer for Hawaii Representative Tulsi Gabbard.
I'm Eileen.
Are you willing to phone bank? Are you willing to canvas? Or do you have a car? I'm like, yes, 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 yes.
During her presidential run, Gabbard received just 2 of nearly 4,000 Democratic delegates. She polled in the low single digits.
It's the craziest thing because I've really never done anything like this before in my life.
Gabbard dropped out March 19th.
I feel like no matter what we do, we can't live a middle-class life.
Lulu Hunt has known Colorado Senator Michael Bennett for 10 years. She left her 2 jobs to follow his campaign around the country. Bennett never rose past low single-digit support in the polls.
Do you think he can win?
I definitely think he can win.
Bennett dropped out the next day. What happens to these passionate voters after a candidate becomes the official Democratic presidential nominee? We directed that question to Case Western Reserve's Justin Buechler, who researches elections and democracy.
The ones who are affiliated with local party organizations will continue to work as activists during the general election campaign, and that will help the eventual nominee, Biden.
For now, the Yang gang is doing coronavirus crisis response. Tepper will restart her career when Broadway opens again, and Hunt is back at her jobs. Carolyn Pursuti, VOA News.
And that's going to do it for us today. You've been listening to International Edition of The Voice of America. On behalf of the entire production team, thank you very much for listening. Be sure to visit our website for in-depth coverage of world events and news 24 hours a day. You can find us online at voanews.com. Until next time, I'm Steve Miller in Washington. Have a great weekend.